Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The journalist Michael Luo has a gut-wrenching story in a recent edition of The New Yorker. It's about the Rock Springs Massacre. On September 2nd, 1885, white rioters overran the Chinese Quarter in Rock Springs, Wyoming, and they took a torch to the place, killed at least 28 Chinese miners. Luo says hundreds fled Rock Springs that day. Some died in the sagebrush wilderness. Some managed to get aboard escape trains sent by Union Pacific. And he told us about a week later, some of them came back, guarded by U.S. soldiers.
They returned to Rock Springs about a week later in the company of soldiers. The scene was that some of the bodies are still not buried and they're being jeered by a crowd of white miners as they arrive back in town and their bodies still on the ground, mangled and decomposing. And there's a statement that the Chinese laborers later wrote, and there's an element of poetry in it. It was a sad and painful sight to see the son crying for the father, the brother for the brother, the uncle for the nephew, and the friend for friend. They bedded down on the ground next to the tracks. The Chinatown that had existed had been burned to the ground, and they were put back to work. It took a bit because at first there were gangs of white miners that were guarding the mine entrances and just scaring off any Chinese miners who were entering. But eventually, coal production resumed with Chinese laborers under guard from American soldiers. I looked at a lot of archival photographs researching this piece, and it's really striking. There's these rail cars in the background, and there's kind of smoke, and there's the sagebrush kind of landscape. If you look more closely, it looks like there are little campfires, and there are images of soldiers, and then there are images of Chinese. And I zeroed in on one Chinese figure whose face is really visible, and he's on the far left of the photograph. He's wearing this wide-brim hat. He's looking directly at the photographer, kind of mid-stride, walking out of the photograph. Your eyes are drawn to him because it looks like he's looking at you. You don't know what he experienced in the massacre, whether he fled for the hills and was wandering through the sagebrush starving. You don't know if he had a friend who was killed or a brother or something like that. It's hard to exactly tell. The issue with the Chinese immigrants in the 19th century is their voices are often missing from the historical archives. And whenever I have a chance to see photographs of Chinese, I often find myself just dwelling on them and wondering about who this person is, their parents, their family, what were their hopes and dreams, what happened to them. And so I just wonder, what is the story of this man who is looking at me 140 years later? You know, the powerful thing about that moment of the Chinese returning to Rock Springs is in the end, this attack failed in its ultimate purpose, which was ejecting the Chinese from Rock Springs. That didn't happen. They came back. And I think that's a powerful statement.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Michael Luo is an executive editor at The New Yorker. His article is part of a new book he's written that comes out next month. And he says the Rock Springs Massacre was part of a moment in U.S. history that's come to be known as the driving out.
Close to 200 communities in 1885, 1886 physically expelled the Chinese from their communities. In some cases violently, in some cases through boycotts and other nonviolent means, but obviously still with coercion. And this is a period that actually few Americans know much about. I actually had never heard of it before I set out on this book project a couple of years ago. A lot of people have heard of the Chinese Exclusion Act, yeah, which is passed in 1882. And that was a law that banned Chinese laborers from entering the United States. The thing that's interesting is, like, so why did this violence happen after they passed this law? There was a anti-Chinese movement that really started to take off in the 1870s, fueled in part by a deep economic downturn. And that led to tens of thousands of unemployed white working men, as they were called, who just, there was a building resentment towards these strangers, mm-hmm, as the book, my book is called Strangers in the Land, and it comes from the Supreme Court decision upholding one of these Chinese exclusion laws. And the Supreme Court Justice Gray refers to the Chinese as strangers in the land. What had happened was they passed this restriction law, and for a while the number of Chinese entering the country declined significantly. But there were other ways around the law. There were, if you were a merchant, you could come in. If you could claim that you were an American citizen born in this country, you were able to come in. When the tide of Chinese did not end, start to lead to this resentment and this anger, and communities decided to take matters into their own hands. The episode that happened just before the Rock Springs Massacre, there was an expulsion of several hundred Chinese in Eureka, California. There was an inciting incident there where a city council member was accidentally shot and killed by a stray bullet. Some rival Chinese gangs were arguing, and a bullet struck a white city council member, and that led to this outpouring of rage, essentially mob violence, that drove out the Chinese from Eureka. That was the opening episode to this driving out, but there was a period, a kind of an interregnum of like 6 months. And when things kind of seemed to be quiet, and then Rock Springs happened.
Yeah.
And after Rock Springs, the proverbial dam sort of breaks, and there's just a succession of these expulsions across the West. And the thing I was trying to figure out is, and this is difficult, I write about this, how historians have a hard time with violence, because there's always an individual explanation. There's an inciting incident, a punch thrown, a shot that was fired. But what leads to these larger cycles? And that's, in many ways, what I'm trying to explore in the larger book.
Let's give listeners a sort of a sense of the setting. It has an air of something that once flourished, now is more Rock Springs, Wyoming. It's, as you describe it, this is sort of today, a kind of fading former mining town.
I open the book in present-day Rock Springs with this archaeological dig that took place in Rock Springs over the summer. The team of archaeologists was excavating this little park. And I wanted to convey, though, what the town is like today. And I describe it as kind of like this vacant landscape, yeah, of sandstone cliffs and sagebrush, which actually is very much what it looked like 140 years ago. The important thing to know, though, is that it used to be a coal mining town. And coal mining was what made Rock Springs, put it on the map. And even today, there's a sign that's still there near the downtown that says Home of Rock Springs Coal. Yeah. Those mines, though, are long ago closed.
That excavation effort you mentioned, they were looking for artifacts, but they were also looking for what you describe as the burn layer. What's the burn layer?
Yeah. they were looking for remnants of a Chinatown that used to stand in Rock Springs and was burned down. And the burn layer would be charcoal ash mixed with the soil that signified that they had found the massacre. And they interviewed this undergraduate student at Grinnell College. The archaeologist who was leading the dig was a woman named Laura Ng. She teaches at Grinnell, and she had an undergraduate named George Mathis, who basically had, I used the analogy to have, he had the archaeological equivalent of a fish on the line. He started to go down in his sector, and he just kept finding things, yeah. You know, just random artifacts. It was about a meter down that he found himself. He described it as almost like he was standing in the middle of a fireplace. He's shoveling his trowel, and it's just all charcoal. And he described to me kind of that bigger picture kind of moment as he kind of stood up and looking at this landscape around him, and he's holding this trowel full of ash. And he said to me that I realize I'm standing on top of one of the most horrible events in Wyoming's history.
You took us through that sort of history of Chinese immigration there, and you got us to that driving out period, as you say. The tension builds and builds and then peaks at that moment of the driving out. For a moment, it seems like there's this – it's nothing's going to happen. You say there's that kind of pause, but then, of course, September 1885 in Rock Springs, the fury, as you put it, spills over. Let's back up a bit and say a little bit about the story of Rock Springs. What was Wyoming like in those days before the railroad? Because you have to understand it in the context. It wouldn't have existed, I don't think, if it weren't for the railroad, I suppose.
Totally. It was basically a place that wagons passed through. Yeah. It was kind of like this vacant landscape. Yeah. And the Union Pacific Railroad, which was, maybe folks still aren't aware, the Transcontinental Railroad, was the Central Pacific and the Union Pacific Railroads, two different railroad companies, the Union Pacific starting in the eastern side of the country, the Central Pacific starting on the west coast and kind of racing to a point, promontory point in Utah is where the Golden Spike was nailed. They're just heading across the plains, and as they're going, towns are springing up. And the railroad needed coal, and it had been known for years, I think, that people had noticed that there was these kind of outcroppings, these black outcroppings in the area that became Rock Springs. And it was the discovery of this in 1868 of this very fruitful vein of bituminous coal that led to the establishment of Rock Springs. And by around 1875, there were about 1,000 people in Rock Springs employed by the Union Pacific, working in the mines.
European immigrants, though, we should point out, at least at this point, right? And they, you describe it as a, I'm trying to imagine what mining was like in those days. You describe it as a pretty rude livelihood, I think is how you put it.
Yeah, they worked in these underground rooms that were, you know, 40 to 60 yards long, yeah. And they used picks and they would lay fuses with gunpowder to help extract the coal. And incredibly dirty, dangerous work. Yeah, it was initially it was European immigrants like Welsh, English, Scottish, Irish immigrants. And it was labor trouble that resulted in Chinese being brought into Rock Springs. There are conflicting accounts who's at fault. The company says that they basically wanted production to be stepped up and the workers kind of refused. The workers have a story that they tell about the company broke a promise to reduce prices in the company store, which they used to buy their supplies. Mm. And basically it resulted in the white workers walking off the job in 1875. And the Union Pacific acted quickly to break the strike, and they brought in Chinese miners and put them to work. And so from that point on, it was a workforce that was heavily Chinese who were working alongside the white miners. And there was this kind of simmering tension that just kind of continued to build as the labor movement kind of started to grow and become more emboldened. And But there was tension because the Chinese workers refused to take part in these work stoppages.
Yeah.
They were also, though, barred from membership in the big union that started to organize in Rock Springs and really became a big force in the anti-Chinese movement was this thing called the Knights of Labor.
Right.
But yeah, it was this labor tension that's kind of also really important to understanding what happened.
Well, to get a sense of that tension, which seemed really intense. I mean, you mentioned November 1875, armed soldiers from the U.S. Army arrive on these train cars. And then a few weeks later, another train car shows up. It also has some soldiers, but it's filled with Chinese miners. And so as they're working, they're being guarded by armed U.S. soldiers. You end up with, at this point, 150 Chinese miners with 50 white miners because they hired some of the white miners back, but only a third of them. So just to get a sense of that simmering tension and resentment, it seems intense right now.
Yeah. Afterwards, one of the contractors for the Chinese miners insisted that there were no real complaints that he was aware of, but that seems to me to be disingenuous. Undoubtedly, there was real resentment. When you read some of the testimony afterwards, when they're interviewing the white workers, they're making all kinds of complaints about Chinese workers and the favoritism that they thought that the mine bosses were showing them. The white workers were paid more, typically a dollar more per day, but they had all these other complaints. Because it was important, you were paid by the bushel of coal that you were able to extract. And they were saying that the Chinese miners got the better assignments. And also when there was a shutdown, that they were hired back first. Yeah, there was just kind of a litany of complaints about the Chinese workers.
So by 1885 then, it seems like the tension and hostility was getting pretty intense. You mentioned one labor leader writing this letter describing a storm brewing. He writes a letter to Union Pacific officials saying, this is the quote here, "For God's sake, do what you can to avoid this calamity." What is he seeing happening?
Yeah, I think he's warning about violence,
that
something's going to go down. You know, the question is, like, is he aware of a larger plot? Was there something in the works that he was aware of, or was he just kind of airing a more generalized warning? And this is one of the most intriguing finds that I had, because it's a big question. The inciting incident to the massacre was a fight that broke out in one of the mines. And what happened was these two white miners came down and they found these two Chinese miners in their room. That's their story, is that this was the room that was assigned to them, that where they were supposed to work, and they found these two Chinese miners there, and this fight broke out. What's indisputable is this skirmish broke out. Whether or not the Chinese miners were in the wrong place or not, that's obviously a subject dispute. The thing that's harder to figure out, and maybe we won't ever really know, is whether there was a larger intentional plot that was afoot. And one of the most interesting archival discoveries is this recollection by a then 19-year-old white miner, a guy named Andrew Bugis. And he tells this story in a kind of unpublished memoir where he remembers colleagues showing up in this cabin that he shared with his cousin. And this miner asking them, his name was Sandy Cooper, asking him if they had a gun, a rifle or a shotgun. And he says, "I will furnish you with one which you must use tomorrow, for we are all going hunting and shooting all the Chinamen we see." And so he thought that Bugis and his cousin thought that this guy was joking. And he returned a little while later with a rifle and some cartridges. And this guy, Sandy Cooper, urged them not to go to work in the morning because he said something about it was important for white miners to be present. And so at that point, it's very confusing. It's not exactly clear what he's saying. But the following day, it becomes more clear what this might have been. The thing, when I look at a document like that, I'm like, this is incredible. This could explain and put to rest once and for all that there was a planned plot to kill the Chinese. But it's just one piece of evidence, one recollection decades later from somebody. And so, yeah, it's just hard to know for sure whether this was a pre-planned plot or kind of a spur-of-the-moment mob that kind of got out of hand.
Michael Luo, he's an executive editor at The New Yorker. We'll put a link to his article about the Rock Springs Massacre on our website, radiowest.org. His new book is called Strangers in the Land. It's being published next month. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Michael Luo is taking us through the story of the Rock Springs Massacre. On September 2nd of 1885, white rioters killed at least 28 Chinese miners and burned down the town's Chinese quarter. Luo tells the story in a recent article in The New Yorker. It's one of the stories in a new book he has coming out next month. He says this was all part of a period that's come to be known as the driving out, where mobs forced hundreds of Chinese immigrants out of communities throughout the West. Okay, so we've arrived on September 2nd. You mentioned there's this fight, this dispute between Chinese miners and white miners working in a particular room of the mine. It gets really ugly. It's a fight. Four of these miners were pretty badly. You mentioned one of them actually later died. So it was a bad fight. But then it really seems to explode. There's a foreman who suggests that something to the effect of, well, we may as well finish it now or something like that. Tell us what happens.
So there was a foreman who came and basically found the white miners getting ready to leave the mine in these pit cars. Mm. And he tries to stop them, actually. Mm. And they say, we're not going to suffer, Chinamen. And he tries to stop them. And that's when one of them calls out, come on, boys, we may as well finish it now. And they walk out together, you know, and he can't stop them. Basically, there was this labor hall that, and the white men gathered in this hall, and there was a chant that was reported, white men fall in. And so they gather in this hall, and then they take a vote, and they decide that the Chinese residents need to be expelled. And so they go to Chinatown, the settlement encampment, and they deliver this ultimatum, you have an hour to pack. Or were I going to, you know, force you to leave? But the reports are that they didn't even wait an hour, and barely a half an hour had passed, and a mob basically descended on Chinatown from two different directions. And that's when, you know, the violence begins in earnest, with people being shot and the encampment being set on fire.
Michael Luo, do you mind talking about some of what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, as much as possible, name the Chinese, because, you know, they're nameless in many cases. And so there's a record of that the Chinese delegation, a report that they later issued that basically lists each person who was killed or injured. And so in that report, they list a name and what happened to them, and in many cases, like anything they know about their family. And so I used that report and other archives to kind of piece together a rendition of what happened and piece it together with kind of the larger movements of this mob. And so I have this paragraph just to give you a sense of like where I'm saying, like, they came from two different directions. One group crossed a plank bridge over Brita Creek, and another advanced from the railroad tracks. A man named Lor's son Kit was the first resident shot. A bullet pierced his back. He crumpled to the ground, wounded but still alive. The rioters shot a 56-year-old miner named Leo Dai Ba in the chest, killing him. A 38-year-old man named Yip Marn was also shot dead. And so, yeah, that gives you a flavor of the violence. There's just horrific scenes. I talk about how there's this creek, they called it Bitter Creek, that had these steep embankments, and Chinese were kind of tumbling down these steep banks, and they're trying to climb up on the other side, and they're getting cut down. And, you know, one man was shot as he was trying to climb up on the other side, and his body was just left half submerged in the creek. There are just scenes of utter mayhem, and people are tossing bodies into burning buildings. It smells of flesh burning. And the miners stored gunpowder inside their houses, which they used to extract the coal. And so when the flames would reach like a cache of gunpowder, the sky would erupt with these explosions. There was a laundryman named Ali who barricaded himself inside his house. He actually had a gun, and he fired a shot, and rioters broke through the roof and shot him in the back of the head. And one detail that's just really striking is a woman, he had bundles of laundry laid out, you know, for delivery, and a woman stole them. So yeah, it's just scenes of utter carnage.
You mentioned one Chinese community leader compared Chinese residents to a flock of frightened sheep. One man spends several days wandering through the sagebrush, eventually finds a train, maybe one, I guess it's one of those escape trains, I guess, gets him to Evanston. There are these kind of contrasting stories that play out that you write about. One was at least a few acts of kindness. One of the Chinese interpreters manages to take shelter in a cellar, makes his way to outside of town, and a resident gives him bread and water, allows him to rest there. So there's this – that was extraordinary. There's another man who managed to reach – I think it was Green River, and a white manager of a hotel helps hide him inside.
Yeah, not everybody participated in the carnage. There were good Samaritans along the way. And it must have taken incredible bravery to stand up to this mob. And when I wrote about other massacres, other expulsions, you hear of these stories. Mm-hmm. It's not everybody that's taken up by this kind of mob.
But then there's the sort of the contrast. Some of the residents approach the pastor, the Reverend Timothy Thurloway, lives near Chinatown. He turns them away.
Yeah, I think he said that you'd be safer if you just left,
yeah,
as opposed to hiding here. Thurloway actually, so he was he lived near the Chinese encampment and had apparently had good relationships with the Chinese because his daughters taught English to Chinese miners. Obviously, there were a lot of pastors who worked with Chinese for kind of evangelical purposes. They're trying to win them over for Christ. And the thing about Reverend Thurloway, he shows up again later when there's a trial of the rioters. And it's the most bizarre thing. There's a grand jury proceeding, and he insisted that the Chinese had set fire to their own quarters, which is just preposterous.
So in the meantime, Michael, talk about what's happening in Rock Springs itself. There's also violence there.
Chinatown basically burned overnight. Yeah. And talking about Good Samaritans, there's a guy named Dave Thomas, who was kind of a friend of the Chinese. They called him Davy Tom. And he has a recollection of the massacre where he talked about how around 7 o'clock that night, they went to see what the situation was, and they spotted an old Chinese man that they knew, probably somebody he was friendly with, and still alive in agony in the dirt. And they're debating whether to shoot him, but in the end they left him to die. And, you know, eventually the local sheriff musters enough deputies to basically prevent further violence. And the following morning, that's when it was you could finally see the hellscape that had resulted from all the violence.
Tell us what the governor does. This is Francis Warren, the governor of Wyoming. He makes an attempt to get the soldiers to help.
Yeah, so Francis Warren is the governor of Wyoming territory at this point. It's a federal territory.
Right.
It's not a state
yeah.
yet. His job is to maintain law and order, obviously. And there are soldiers there stationed in the area, and he's trying to get the order to dispatch them to protect the town. And the problem was the president, Grover Cleveland, was not in the White House. He was in the Adirondacks hiking and fishing and was unreachable. And there was some back and forth of, like, when Warren sent this telegram requesting federal help, there was a little bit of a delay because he hadn't properly invoked what he needed to invoke in order to get this federal help. Usually it's the territorial legislature that was supposed to make this request, and the territorial legislature was out of session. Initially, when Warren sends this request for federal troops, two companies of troops were sent, but their orders were only to prevent the interruption of federal mail, like that, not to do anything about, you know, protecting the Chinese or protecting the safety of the town. They were basically just meant to make sure the mail service wasn't halted. And so the Union Pacific is, they're frantic. They're trying to get help in any way they can, and just saying that the Chinese who had gathered in Evanston were also at risk for another attack. And finally, Cleveland, on September 6th, the massacre took place on September 2nd. It was finally 4 days later. He finally emerged from the wilderness, and he got a briefing. And 2 days later, he ordered federal soldiers to protect Chinese miners at all hazards. And so that's what brings us full circle back to that photo that you and I talked about, where the soldiers accompanied these Chinese miners back to Rock Springs.
You write about how this kind of fury had the potential of being contagious, and the violence could have really spread to other communities. That you mentioned how here in the Utah Territory, Chinese miners had been given 20 minutes to leave a certain town in Evanston, Wyoming. Another effort to drive out the Chinese, the Green River. I mean, it seemed like contagious in some way.
Yeah, it was. One of my chapters is called Contagion. There is something about this that it just kind of has this cascading effect. And they see what happened in Rock Springs. These other towns see it as a model, something that they could emulate.
I wanted you to ask about how the officials from China's diplomatic delegation, how they react to all of this. They go to Rock Springs. I think what's interesting about this part of the piece you write is the report that they work through. It's a final report by the Chinese consul in New York. And you mentioned how it has this litany of the dead. And you say it seemed to be this litany not only of accountability, but also of memory, is how you put it. What do you mean?
Yeah, I just thought it was really powerful the way they listed the dead. I alluded to it earlier. It wasn't just bare bones. There was details about, obviously, what killed them and their injuries, but also they talked about their family. You know, just reading one of them, this is a good example. It says, the dead body of Yi Siyan was found near the creek. The left temple was shot by a bullet and the skull broken. The age of the deceased was 36 years. He had a mother living at home in China. There's another one. The dead body of Liu Dibao was found at the side of the bridge near the creek, shot in the middle of the chest by a bullet, breaking the breastbone. I also ascertained that the deceased was 56 years old and had a wife, son, and daughter at home. I don't know why the Chinese consul wrote it this way. I mean, the purpose of this report in some ways was to seek financial redress for the survivors. It was also obviously to render a report of what happened. And so perhaps one of the reasons that they're listing relatives is just talking about how these people were providers and helping make the case that they should be compensated for their loss.
So what happens to mining operations during all of this? They must grind to a halt for a time.
Yeah, it stopped for a bit. They were struggling to restart the mines, and because of the Chinese were frightened off, and for initial period, the white miners who were kind of menacing them and standing guard at the in front of the mines were able to keep them out. But eventually, they were able to get back to work and resume production. By the end of September, there were 250 Chinese laborers back at work, and the company began rebuilding Chinatown. And interestingly, there was actually, you know, because a lot of white workers still were refusing to work, which was also complicated in terms of resuming coal production, because they often did other jobs like, you know, weighing the coal and placing on train cars and that kind of thing. And Union Pacific officials arranged to bring in Mormon miners.
Yeah.
Mormons were another kind of persecuted group. And there was still sporadic harassment, violence towards Chinese laborers going on. And there were reports of these, like in October, there was this gang of white men who attacked a group of Chinese who were at a railroad depot west of town and drove them into the woods. And they resumed operations, and there was still this simmering tension.
Michael Luo, he's an executive editor at The New Yorker. His recent article is called Tragedy at Rock Springs. We'll put a link to it on our website. His new book is due out next month. It's called Strangers in the Land, Exclusion, Belonging, and the Epic Story of the Chinese in America. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Michael Luo. He's telling us the story of the Rock Springs Massacre. Well, you mentioned before that in the end, the purpose, I guess, the purpose of this massacre didn't work. It didn't get rid of the Chinese people from Rock Springs.
Yeah, they failed in their ultimate purpose. And Chinese miners continued to work in Rock Springs for the Union Pacific for years, even decades to come, guarded by federal soldiers. The soldiers were finally withdrawn, I think around 1913. Yeah. And, you know, this was a controversial thing. Ase, who was the leader of the Chinese who returned to Rock Springs, whenever there was talk of withdrawing the soldiers, he lobbied against this. And then one interesting detail is that Ase actually brought his family, his wife and his children, back to China, and he returned by himself. And so clearly he didn't think that they were safe there. Hmm. Yeah, so the Chinese miners continue to work for the Union Pacific. You know, at this point, though, the Chinese miners were aging, and many of them were old and couldn't work in the mines anymore. And they had become basically wards of the state, like they were paupers, and the company would give them handouts. And so there was a decision made in 1925 that they would send the remaining Chinese back to China with a lump sum for their years of faithful service. And so groups of Chinese started to return to China. And speaking of photographs, there are photographs of these Chinese as they're waiting to board the ship or actually before they leave. And I find them extraordinary to look at because in many of the photographs, they actually are wearing like these three-piece suits. And it's just really interesting because like the company kind of held this banquet to send them off. And, you know, they each have extraordinary stories. In this first group, there was a 70-plus-year-old miner named Lao Cheng who had been shot in the back, and he still had a bullet in his back, and he was in that first group to go back. And so that photograph of that first group going back, it's pretty extraordinary to see. Mm-hmm.
So what about the efforts to bring any of the rioters to justice? What was the – you write about this in the piece, the attempt. Yeah. I mean, as you say, most of the residents were sympathetic to the white miners. Yeah.
Yeah, they basically no one would testify against them. And so there were 24 white residents called to stand, but none were willing to implicate any of the rioters. They would need Chinese witnesses to identify the rioters. And this is another point that is a little bit contradictory in the record. There was a federal prosecutor who was observing the proceedings, and he wrote in a memo afterwards that the local prosecutors had been hoping that they would get help from this guy named Frederick B., who was the Chinese consul in San Francisco. He's a pretty extraordinary figure. Frederick B. is a white man who became close with the Chinese and worked alongside them and was one of the people who came to Rock Springs to help investigate the massacre. They said that they had been hoping that he would help arrange for Chinese testimony. But there was an interview of B. In a San Francisco newspaper who said that no one ever followed up with him, and he would have helped produce witnesses if he had been asked. And he basically just says that they didn't really pursue this very seriously. And so the grand jury returned no indictments. And there have been a few rioters who have been arrested, and they kind of returned in triumph to Rock Springs. Several hundred people came out to greet them, and they were kind of returning heroes.
Yeah, let me read that part of the article, because this is the another part of the story that's hard to take. The rioters returned that night to Rock Springs, where a cheering throng of several hundred residents greeted them.
You imagine the kind of hero's welcome that they got, these men who had been in jail. I guess it's been about a month, and they're free men. And many of them, I think, continue to live in Rock Springs for years to come.
Where does this story fit in the larger story of the country? I mean, you mentioned, before we were talking about how historians have a difficult time telling the larger sort of story about violence. And they also have a hard time telling the story of Chinese immigrants and including how they fit into that, you know, that broader narrative. I mean, you mentioned how the story is playing out in the period after the Civil War. So where does it fit in the picture of race in the United States?
This was all taking place in that kind of post-Civil War period. And I have this line in the piece where I say that the Chinese question followed the Negro question and coincided with the vanquishing of Reconstruction, the spread of Jim Crow, and the subjugation of Native peoples on the Western frontiers. These histories continue to refract through American life today. Nevertheless, the atrocities experienced by Chinese residents of the country remain little known. The point I was trying to make when I was trying to put that in context is the story of race in America is often thought of in a very binary way through the lens of black and white. And what I'm trying to do with this piece and with this book is to introduce the Chinese into that story, to introduce Asian Americans into that story. There have been other scholars, other authors who have been trying to put forth the story of indigenous people, native peoples into that story, because it's all of a piece.
Yeah.
You know, the term white supremacy, I think, I don't use it very easily. And I think sometimes it can be thrown around without really being precise about what it means. But clearly the country has a history where people who are not white experienced bigotry, violence, repressive laws, were persecuted, and that's an important part of our history. And it's a strand of our history that continues to return. I wrote in a different piece that America's exclusionary present reflects its exclusionary past, and it's important to be aware of this history when trying to understand the present moment.
It's interesting. You write about this former professor of history and archaeology at Western Wyoming Community College, a guy named Dudley Gardner. He's really the expert on the massacre in a lot of ways. But you say in the piece that over the years, Gardner's had to kind of overcome this reluctance on the part of some residents in Wyoming to really get into the story. What do you understand about that?
So, you know, this is Western Wyoming, and it's pretty conservative. That's one thing. He was talking about some people in the community who have relatives who actually perpetrated the massacre and were reluctant to dig up the past, really. Mm. The thing that's a tribute to Dudley is he's been in his community for decades, and he's been able to build relationships and trust with people, and was able to successfully negotiate to have this excavation take place this past summer, and they're going to return next summer to finish their work and to keep digging into this past. That's really a tribute to the trust that he's built up in this community.
Well, let me ask you finally, where you think this moment of history fits into today's political landscape. I mean, another thing you've written in another piece was that, you know, President Trump's assertions that he's going to use executive action to, on one hand, you know, abolish birthright citizenship. You say that there's an historical link there to the Chinese-American experience. So how do you make the connection between then and now, I guess?
Yeah. So the Chinese were the strangers in the land in the 19th century and were the targets of this anti-immigrant agenda. Today, it's not the Chinese. There are others who are perceived as strangers. You know, obviously, much of this is people from Latin America, from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Venezuela. And I see a lot of the same themes, perception that they're taking jobs, which actually, by the way, is often misplaced. There's been some really interesting work done by economists that look back at the Chinese, and after Chinese exclusion was passed, they found that there's no evidence that the average white worker benefited from the departure of the Chinese, and that the positive effects of Chinese immigrants on the workforce, you know, you're thinking about like economies of scale and some kind of other opportunities that kind of emerged without them there, some of these benefits resulted in, you know, a loss of jobs. And there's similar studies today that talk about how immigration, the surge in immigration has actually strengthened the economy. So I see that linkage. Birthright issue is explicit. So President Trump is challenging this precedent since 1896. The Supreme Court precedent comes from a case of a Chinese immigrant named Wong Kim Mark. Mm-hmm. There was a test case that was brought at the turn of the century where they were trying to make the case that he should not be considered an American citizen, even though he was born in the United States. And the Supreme Court ruled that under the 14th Amendment, he was a citizen. And that has governed our understanding of citizenship ever since. And it's being challenged and put to the test now by the Trump administration. And it's fascinating to me to see this repeat of history with a different group of people.
Michael Luo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Michael Luo. He's an executive editor at The New Yorker. We'll put a link to his article about the Rock Springs Massacre on our website, radiowest.org. His new book is coming out next month. It's called Strangers in the Land: Exclusion, Belonging, and the Epic Story of the Chinese in America. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can just email us at radiowest@kuer.org. This program was produced by our intern, Katrina Cano, along with Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.